Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, I want to welcome everyone that's on this line. thank you for being a part of this show today. I'm Geraldine Hollis, Geraldine Edwards Hollis, a part of the Tougaloo Nine. Today, we will have people on that would share something with you that you may never have heard before. Our moderator today is Michael O'Brien. He is the author of We Shall Not Be Moved. And he has been a person that I've been in touch with for some years now. And I want him to be able to guide us through this wonderful day of bringing the Tougaloo Nine together. This is Voices of Wisdom, and our benefactor is the CEO of We Shall Overcome This Time, but Gumbo for the Soul, Tribe Family Radio, Miss Beverly Black. And right now, let me see if we have all of our participants online. Mr. Michael O'Brien, Mike, are you on?
I'm here, Geraldine.
Thank you. Do you know what a relief that is to hear your soft voice, the voice that I know that is going to guide us through this, and I can just sit back and just be so comfortable knowing that you are there. Okay. Engineer will let us know who is on, and those who are on will speak up. I'm just going to give this introduction. I know for a fact that we have Ms. Patty Farr on, who is the director of the Jackson Municipal Library. So at any time that we have any questions or some things that she can be a part of, please allow her to be able to do that. But for Ms. Patty Farr, please just sit back and enjoy all of this that you've had such a great hand in. We do have Joseph Jackson on already, and I do hope that we have quite a few of the Tougaloo Nine and the family of Ms. Dr. Amina Omar on, and that will be determined as we move along. For everyone, I want to get the housekeeping things out because I want to be a person that's in the audience. However, we will be allowed 1 hour and 20 minutes, not a minute over. So all of you that have something to say, we want to make sure that we get it done in that time frame. Thank you, and I'm going to move over and let Mr. Mike O'Brien speak to us and moderate this program. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Geraldine, and it's a wonderful honor to be here to try to move things along and interview those of you who are on the line about the Tougaloo Nine, about what it is that brought you to that moment that you felt you needed to take a stand, and kind of what you have done with your lives since then. That's kind of the trajectory I hope that we can follow, while also, of course, talking about the demonstration itself. Now, I was led to believe that besides Joseph Jackson, we might have a couple of other Tougaloo Nine members on the line. So, Geraldine, do you know if they have joined us yet?
I will get a text from our engineer if there's any others as they come in.
Okay.
Right now, I know that I did have confirmations from Mr. Alfred Cook. We would like to know if he's on. The engineer will let us know. And Ms. Janice Jackson-Vales. So our
Great.
Engineer would let us know if she's on.
And you may just want to, while we're kind of setting this up, if you want to just text them with the call-in number or remind them of the time, that would be great. So hopefully they'll be able to join us as we move along.
Okay.
And I know that Joseph and Geraldine yourself and I have had a conversation last month's show. So maybe for those of you who haven't heard from the library director from Jackson, Mississippi, Patty Furr, she is really the leading force of what enabled most of the Tougaloo Nine to return to Jackson in August of last year in order to participate in the unveiling of a special historic marker on the site where the Tougaloo Nine Library sit-in occurred. And Patty, I wonder if you have a few words and what is it that inspired you about this story and pushed you to move in the direction of getting that kind of recognition for the group?
Certainly. Well, I'm delighted to be a part of this evening. I want to bring you greetings from Jackson Heights Library System and our system board. We are primarily an African-American urban library system. I first became aware of Tougaloo Nine because we had some reenactments of the sit-in that our library system had done using some of our staff and Tougaloo Nine students. And I was very moved when I was able to see those events. And I did meet Geraldine when she came through Jackson in Freedom Summer. I became aware that this wonderful group of people who had such an early effect on the civil rights movement, they had never been recognized formally. And certainly we have a great deal of pride in our library system that we have part of civil rights history in our own library history. So I was really quite taken with Geraldine's story, and I knew that my library board would be very supportive of a recognition for the Tougaloo Nine. So I decided to ask them to fund the cost, civil rights marker, which is right out in front of the old municipal library on State Street here in Jackson. And we started the process that led to all of them coming, all but one coming last August.
And what a wonderful gathering that was. I was fortunate to be able to be there as well in that hot Mississippi sun in August. A gathering of all of the nine who then had a chance to tell their story across the street in the Eudora Welty Library after the dedication ceremony. So we so appreciate your efforts in getting that recognition. And one of the wonderful things that those who were present were able to participate in, at least those who were the activists who participated in the library sit-in itself, they got an early tour of the new Civil Rights History Museum, which is very nearby the library. And boy, did they do a great job of honoring the Tougaloo Nine with a full wall, covering the whole story of how they came to all participate in that event, plus, photos, the whole coverage.
I was quite because I did not know what would be at the Civil Rights Museum. I knew that I could get them a tour, but I wasn't sure how big or how significant their exhibit was going to be. So I was behind them as they came in. And, of course, we were moving around some of the exhibits that were still being set up. And since I was behind them, I heard the shouting and the laughing. And I figured it must be something good, and it was very good. They were amazed to see the life-size photo of themselves on the wall. And it was also featured recently when President Donald Trump came through for his 15-minute tour, and he stopped right in front of their photos. So I thought that was really interesting.
That's a backhand story that not most people would know, right? Perfect.
So he stood right in front of their life-size photo and answered a few questions. So that was pretty neat.
Well, let's hope that has an impact on his thinking. That would be wonderful.
Certainly.
So, Joseph Jackson, happy to have you back.
Michael, it is really an honor for me to be back, especially what a wonderful radio program we had the last time that you were on. And you always inspire me. But this here, really, as far as I'm concerned, is a double blessing granted unto me from the universe to have Miss Patty Fair on the show. And Patty, you there?
I'm here.
Patty, I was unable to make it to the event honoring the 209 when the mailers, the marker, was being presented. I think that was on August 17th of last year. And because I have glaucoma. But
fine.
Now I am really blessed to be able to speak to you in person to just let you know how thankful and how grateful I am to really be recognized by someone like yourself, and to have sent me, of course, the DVD of the reenactment, and also to thank you for the medallion. And I'm really honored to be part of your spirit, and thank you so much.
Well, I can tell you, you were in everybody's hearts that day, and I can tell you that you were very much a part of it, even though you were there in spirit, if not in body. And it was a real wonderful occasion. I was honored to be there and just to hear the Tugaloo Nine tell their stories. It was quite amazing.
Well, I was fortunate enough to see, what you looked like when you sent me the DVD, because June of that same year, 2014, we were participants, me and my son, in the Medgar Evers Parade, and that was on June 7th of 2014. And lo and behold, the following month, I believe it was, the event was August the 27th, wasn't it, or the 28th? When you had the honoring us. But anyway, I was glad that I was able to see such a wonderful-looking lady, and forgive my charm. Forgive my charm, because, you know, I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, so that's in our DNA as gentlemen.
Well, let's pick up on that, because,
you
know, I was just before the program, I was just reconfirming my understanding of where all the Tugaloo Nine members were from, and almost to a person, y'all had either were directly from Mississippi or had direct or deep roots in the state of Mississippi. I think two of y'all were from Vicksburg. One was from Laurel. A couple were from right in the Delta, Clarksdale. Janice was from Clarksdale. Ethel actually came from a very small town in the Delta, Malvina, but moved to Memphis when she was a child. Geraldine, of course, from Natchez. Meredith Anding was from Jackson. And three of you were, you know, actually Joe and Sam. Joe, you had some roots in Belzoni from your mother's side, right? And
Michael, you're awesome. Michael, go on, Michael, you're awesome.
I've done my homework, right? So Joe and Sam Bradford, and also Ethel, you know, primarily from Memphis. And I love the little anecdote that people say about Mississippi. They say, you know, Mississippi has three major cities: Memphis, New Orleans, and Birmingham. And, you know, suggesting that there's no major city in the state. And I know we got a lot of Mississippians listening, so I apologize in advance. But, you know, but Memphis was so, you know, right over the line from Mississippi. And then all of you kind of took your lead to go to school, you know, at Tougaloo in various ways. And Joe, maybe you can kind of tell us a little bit about your lead up into how you made that decision, why you made that decision, what was going on in your life at that time.
Well, the decision that was made, it was made for me because at that time I was an ordained minister in the Christian church, known as the Disciples of Christ. And after I finished my freshman year at Arkansas A&M College and returning back to Memphis, I decided that I wanted to continue my education. And so I wrote the mission, the Board of Missions of the Disciple of Christ, requesting the possibility of me being granted a ministerial scholarship. And it was granted, but in granting me the scholarship, I found myself at one of their affiliated Christian colleges, which happens to have been Tougaloo. And I didn't know where in the hell, pardon my French, Tougaloo was, let alone Tougaloo, Mississippi. So that decision was made for me. And so I attended Tougaloo on September 1960 on a ministerial scholarship and as a philosophy and religion major.
And Geraldine, you too came to Tougaloo in an interesting way from your hometown of Natchez. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yes. I came from Natchez, Mississippi, and I had several colleges around me. That was Alcorn there in the county, Natchez College right there in Natchez. And, of course, there was the colleges in Louisiana because we were very close to the Louisiana border. So we had Southern, we had the ones in New Orleans, some of the ones there that we had the options to go to, and especially because I had family there. So my family would have been more interested in me going where there were close family members. But I found out about Tougaloo, and I wanted to go and see how and what Tougaloo was all about. That was one of the best things that I had done in my college search or looking for a college. And I want to just share with you that I was able to go to some of the other college campuses, but Tougaloo was really so serene and had the atmosphere that I felt so comfortable in. And when I looked at the campus, not only the landscape, but the buildings, talking with the students who were there during the summer. It was up and running during the summer. And seeing these students from various other countries and being introduced to the staff, the teachers and those people who were there on that campus just gave me such a great feeling of this is where I really would love to be. It is no joke that I wrote in my book and had so many memories of just being on that campus within those confines and behind that gate that is the opening door the very gates of the campus, and it is a nice big gate there. It's for real. Behind those gates, I found some of the things that I really wanted to be a part of at Tougaloo.
Well, and I know we're trying to represent the other folks who are not able to be on the line, and many of them had, you know, interesting and sometimes difficult approaches to getting to college, you know, needing that scholarship or not being expected necessarily to go to college. I know Ethel Sawyer told me that, you know, she fully expected, because she knew her family couldn't afford it, to go into, you know, the military, go into the Army or some other branch of the military. But her high school, you know, counselor sat her down and said, your scores on these tests are too high for you to not pursue a college education. And so they figured out a way of, you know, putting it all together so that she could get a scholarship and get to Tougaloo.
That's awesome.
The same with Sam Bradford, and we'll pick up on this because I know that, again, if we kind of try to group people in their different settings, three of the nine, including Joe Jackson, were members of the chorus. You know,
Michael, you are awesome. I can't wait for you to finish your book.
But Joe and Sam Bradford and Albert Lasseter all kind of made their way to Tougaloo partly because of Pops Lovelace and their voices. Joe, you want to talk a little bit about that?
Michael, I'm really trying to be very, very incognito, but you're putting a lot of things out of me. You see, that's new to me. You know, I didn't even mention Pops, but you
did.
That's
my job.
But now, since you have opened up a can of worms. I met Pops when Pops came to my high school, Booker T. Washington High School in Memphis, and because of my gift of voice, I'm a operatic tenor, and my idol was Mario Lanza, and I listened to Mario Lanza from the age of 13 on to the present time, and I sang in the Glee Club from my freshman year right on through my senior year. So Pops came to the senior class and asked Professor E.L. Pender, who were some of his top singers, and Mr. Pender pointed me out, and a friend of mine who is now deceased, Benny Jenkins, also was a classical tenor. So that's how I ended up meeting Pops when he awarded me a scholarship to Arkansas A&M College that freshman year. Well, after I finished my freshman year, I got married in 1958, and my daughter was born. I was unable to go back to college. And then finally, Pops, in the spring of 1960, sent me a letter while he was on vacation. He was in Ohio, and he said that he thought of me and that he was going to try to secure a scholarship, law scholarship, from the faculty at Tougaloo College. But what I had to do, I had to audition that spring for the faculty, and I did. And then, lo and behold, I was granted a Vora scholarship. So that's how I ended up in the choir. So I had a ministerial scholarship and a Vora scholarship.
Well, one of these days, we're going to have to hear you sing.
Now, you might have to pay for that, Mike.
Okay.
I love you, though.
But, you know, Sam had the same experience. Was able to get to Tougaloo on a scholarship thanks to Pops. And, you know, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, that Pops you know, he dedicated his life to the choral work at historically black colleges, and I believe he's buried on the campus of Tougaloo College.
Well, you told me, you sent me a picture of the burial grounds with his wife and Dr. Ernest Berinsky, who was another mentor of mine in sociology. And you remember, you sent me a picture
Yes.
of the three graves.
Right, and we'll get to Dr. Berinsky in a minute, but let's just pull back into some of the others who are not, and if anybody else is on the call, please, speak up and we'll bring you into the discussion. There's a wonderful story, and I was hoping that Janice Jackson would be able to tell it. Janice, of course, from Clarksdale, and who had a wonderful, wonderfully positive and kind of determined spirit. You can see it even in the pictures when she's at the library and the police are leading you all away. Janice, a rather tall young woman at the time, just standing tall and almost, one would also perhaps say, defiant. And she got that type of demeanor that, was basically, I belong here, and you can't stop me. I have just as much right to be here as anyone, which is kind of what her demeanor is saying. She got that from her father in Clarksdale, and they lived in the city, in the downtown area of Clarksdale. Of course, Clarksdale, important in the civil rights universe because it is the home of Aaron Henry, who for many years was the statewide president of the NAACP, worked directly with Medgar Evers. But Janice, on her way to Tougaloo, took a bus. And lo and behold, when she gets on the bus, who is on that bus but Ethel Sawyer coming from Memphis. And they met up on the bus, talked their ears off on their way to Tougaloo, and became best friends and have been best friends ever since. And that's just an amazing coincidence, right, that on the bus they would meet on the way to Tougaloo.
Wow.
So that's, and then they would end up, doing the library sit-in together. So just a fascinating connection. I interviewed both of them together. And they're just a great, they're a great team, and still now live. They both live in the St. Louis area. Ethel direct in downtown St. Louis, and Janice actually lives in Ferguson and was there during the uprising a few years back. So just fascinating stories. So Geraldine, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your experiences at Tougaloo, and particularly in the lead up to the sit-in. What kind of drew you in, and what was it that caused you to feel that, yes, this is what I'm called to do?
Mike, you are just so great, and I know that you were chosen for this moderation for all of those special reasons. For me, I was the only girl and the oldest in my family. There were five boys behind me. Being an only girl and the oldest, I always wanted to be first. Not that I wanted to be first in being a challenge or to make a difference at Tougaloo, but it was just a part of my nature to want to be able to make a difference. So, coming to Tougaloo, I really was the first in my family. Just looking back over those years, the first in the family on both sides that went to college. And because I wanted to leave home, where people are very comfortable being around family and home, for me to leave and go somewhere that I'd never really been before, and also to really want to be in college, that was a big deal. And it seems as though quite a few of our members came from families with as a minister in the family or a preacher or a pastor.
Yeah.
And I think we are finding this out as we have come along over the years. But my dad was a pastor and minister in our area, and he also worked in one of the big plants there, International Paper Mill. So there wasn't a lot of money for me, and I didn't have the highest amount of grades, but I was second in my class. Might have been third, but anyway, I wasn't a valedictorian or anything like that, but I did have a very high. The reality is that I wanted to move forward in my life. I wanted to get into education, and I had been mentored from the fifth grade, really believe this, by a teacher that I was acquainted with when I was in elementary school. Because I was one of those students who, out on the playground, I pulled all of the students around me and I showed them things that I could do, and I worked with them, and we did tumbling, we did working on the bars and things like that. And I did make a notation somewhere that, you know, we didn't wear any pants during those years. Everything was a skirt or a dress. So I had to find ways to tumble and do things on campus. And then I learned how to pin my dress or my skirt up so that I could do these things. Now, this is leading somewhere.
Okay.
Because you've got to have mentors in your life. You've got to have someone that inspires you. And although I'd never really known about college except what I read in some of the magazines or whatever, I never had anyone in my family to direct me into these things. So this teacher asked me to come up to her room when I was in the fifth grade, and she asked me what it was that I was doing and why did I do that and how did I learn those things. And I shared with her that I just felt like doing those things, and that's, you know, I felt okay doing those. And so she got my name and everything, and so the very second year after that, we moved into a new school, and I was in middle school then, seventh grade. And she kept in touch with me, and what she did, she says, I want you to come to the gym, and I want you to demonstrate some things to my class. And so even though I was in the middle school, still in the same facility, she would get me quite often, and she would let me do some things, and she would tell me how to do things. And so what I did, I just really felt great in being able to do those things. She went to college every summer, and she went to Texas Women's College, and she would come back, and during the summer she would tell me things that I could do. She'd tell me what she learned, and this was some great mentoring for me. So her name was Miss Haynes, and she is a part of my history. Miss Haynes probably is the one that really gave me the idea about going to college, and also in getting me ready for going to college. And she was a math teacher, and she also was the physical education teacher. So working with Miss Haynes over the years, she gave me the job of being a helper during the summers, working with her with recreation. So I learned how to be outgoing. I learned how to be responsible. I learned how to work with games and activities and set up and dealing with people, the teenagers and all that I had to deal with. So I got a lot from learning just with Ms. Haynes. Mike, can you take over for a minute?
1, 2, 0.
Sure.
That's all right. That's all right. It's not one of our Tougaloo people calling.
Okay.
Yes. Okay.
Did you want to continue then, Geraldine?
Yes.
You want me to jump in?
I can continue with just this part. And then I went to Tougaloo, and I went there, and I knew that I wanted to be a physical education major. And that's when I met the students on campus who were from Panama and all of the other countries in the Caribbean areas who were there because they could not go home during the summers. So it gave me an idea that I could do this also, and especially since my family had such a large family and not a lot of money. So my idea was to be able to do all that I could to save my family and also to move forward in my life. And I decided at that time that I wanted to try to go to school in the 3 years and three summers and finish my degree, and that was my goal. So it was during my second year that I was not quite a junior, and I was not quite all the way a sophomore, but I was in between. And I decided that I would, after the Christmas holiday, that I would come back and work with the group that was planning the demonstration for to make a difference in Jackson. So that's my take on how I got there. Now,
well, you talk about being a phys ed major and always being the kind of person who needed to move and wanted to learn new things on how to express yourself with your body. And you always remind me of that story when you were arrested and were in jail in order to kind of, kind of work off the tension and also just kind of be yourself. You were doing all kinds of dancing inside the jail cell. And that's always stuck with me.
Yes. Yes, I danced while we were in the jail. I really did. Yes.
You want to talk about that a little bit? What was on your mind when you were doing those dances? Was it a way of, working off the tension or just keeping active?
I think it was a bit of both. Because we were confined, we didn't know what our circumstances were going to be. You have to realize that, and for the audience, we lived in some times when we could have lost everything.
Exactly.
Our lives were in danger, our careers were in jeopardy, and our families were definitely in jeopardy. So,
I think that's one point that is lost by most people today. And when I spoke to almost every one of you, that point was uppermost in your mind, that this was the first major demonstration in the city of Jackson, and there was no precedent for what might happen. And for all of you, because of the repressive nature of the political system there against black people, almost to a person, believe that this could cost you your life or certainly the livelihood of your families because you were mostly all local. That's why I was bringing in the local piece, that it was a local movement, local uprising. And many people thought that Mississippi, the folks wouldn't have the kind of courage to step up because they had been beaten down so hard so many times. But you all proved that a local movement could begin and could be started, but at great cost, perhaps, to yourselves and to your loved ones.
That is so true. And when I was dancing, I'm sure that was the way that I used in order to neutralize the apprehension that I had, and also because we didn't know what the timeline would be, to be able to do something that would make a difference. And also, it got everybody relaxed, smiling.
Right.
I was doing all of these things. And there were four of us, the four girls were in the two cells. And these were not regular cells. These were the holding tanks. And the holding tanks were different from the regular cells. These were very, I would say, unkept places. They were smelly. They were not clean. It could have been the last vomited person, the last intoxicated person. So really, we didn't even feel comfortable being in there, let alone a place to rest or relax.
So you lighten the mood, too.
That's it. We had to do something. I felt, hey, I'm going to do this. And so I did that. I'm not sure just how long I did that. Of course, you know, that's been 57 years this year.
56 years.
So I can still remember.
Mm-hmm.
I can still remember some of those things, but to be able to be quite honest, I don't remember how long, because it was a very long time. I don't think that we slept very much at all because it wasn't conducive to sleeping. It wasn't conducive to really being there. So dancing did make a difference because it pulled away from the reality of what was happening to us. And
well,
as
and
I
you
said,
all,
it was
I can just
girls.
Fill in some blanks there. Did I just hear someone come on? I could just fill in some of the blanks there in terms of, you know, you were there for 30 some hours. Because, in my estimation, the police made a big mistake. Remember, this is the first time they had ever had this happen. They weren't sure what to do. And you were supposed to be bailed out right away. And Medgar and others had raised the bail money. But when they brought it down to the court, the bondsman had left. He had left for the day, recognizing that, you know, this was something very unusual, and I don't know if he was given a signal to leave, but as a result, you were not able to be bonded out. And so, and I think that was the biggest mistake that the police or the political system made, because that brought so much attention from the black community in Jackson and from the colleges all around Jackson State. You know, they had a demonstration and an uprising, Campbell College, and of course Tougaloo. So it was fascinating that I'm sure it was surprising that you were kept for so long. And then one of the additional pieces of tension that I'd like perhaps each of you to talk about is that you were each brought in individually and interrogated by a number of the Jackson City police officers. About who put you up to all this. Joe, you want to take that one?
Well, yes, I would take that up. That was true. You know, they asked us, well, not they, but the chief of police began asking us who was our leader as we sat in the all white library. That was the first question that Chief Pierce asked us. Who is your leader? And then, of course, when we were interrogated, it was the same question. But you see, we knew that we were. They knew who was really planning or had planned this demonstration. They knew the name of the field secretary. It was Medgar Ellis. But they wanted us to tell them that it was Medgar. But then we knew that once we were interrogated, all of us knew we were not going to really tell them who our leader was. And I think that really caused them to become even, I would say, more angry at us, because we were in solidarity with regards to what we was going to say. And we said very little. It wasn't that much to say. But they just kept prodding, who is your leader, who is your leader? But then if you remember, Michael, even before, the sit-in, Medgar was involved in the bus, not the bus boycott, but the boycotting of the businesses that spring, Michael. And when I bought the book, A Hero, Medgar Evers' speeches, writings, and his letters.
Yes.
I bought that book, Michael, in 2005. And it was from reading that book that Medgar, in his letter to Roy Wilkins, asking us, of course, the possibility of coming to Philadelphia, to speak. I found out that we were held in custody for 32 hours. Not only that, but I realized I had become the successor to the previous president of the NAACP Youth Council. His name was Reverend Otis Smith. Reverend Otis Smith was involved in the boycotting of the businesses during the Easter week. And it's strange that when I arrived on the campus in 1960, the Youth Council elected me president while Reverend Otis Smith was going to call it on the boycott charges of disturbing the peace. That was something. Reverend Otis Smith and I became his successor, and they elected me, another minister.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that boycott up, and I'll just bring in a couple of other members of the Tougaloo Nine, because each of them, or some of them, had had previous experience kind of on the front lines. Al Cook participated in that boycott of 1960 at Easter time when he was a student at Campbell College. But and even though the president of the college was very supportive, there were others, including the president's wife, who were not happy that students from Campbell College had partaken in this demonstration. So Al ended up going to Tougaloo as a result of that. I don't know that he was dismissed, but it was clear that his approach to activism was not appreciated on Campbell's campus. So that's how Al got to Tougaloo. And then also Meredith Anding, as I mentioned, was from Jackson, and I'll tell you that he was related to one of the major forces in Black Jackson activism at the time. A.M.E. Logan was his aunt, his mother's sister, and force in and of herself. But Meredith had also, you know, felt that things weren't happening in Jackson the way they were in the rest of the South, and he and some of his buddies on their own went to the Jackson Zoo, and you know, kind of they got picked up. I don't think they were formally arrested. They were sent, given back into the custody of their parents. But I think that was when Meredith was in high school. So you know, others had participated in various attempts to get things going in Jackson. Of course, Medgar was very much involved in both of those demonstrations, as well as, of course, the Tougaloo Nine as well. Anyway, so I thought I would try to bring in their stories at that point. Well, you know, I know that with previous radio shows, y'all have talked quite a bit about the demonstration itself. One thing that's fascinating to me, and possibly one of the reasons that the Tougaloo 9 until this point have not gotten a lot of recognition, is that once the demonstration was over, even though the citizens of Jackson rose up, there was a real concern for your safety. Once you were released, once your trial was over, you all went back to campus, and life kind of returned to normal. And there wasn't a major movement that resulted from the demonstration, but it was really many people that I've talked to were so inspired by what you did that they used that inspiration and later got involved in demonstrations that followed, even though they followed a year or two later. But what's fascinating to me is that many of you didn't stay at Tougaloo for a variety of reasons, either, you know, money issues or family issues, or in one case, concern about his own safety. Many of you moved on after that semester to other colleges. But what's fascinating to me is really what you all did with the rest of your lives, because to a person, the Tougaloo 9, I believe, represents kind of the, because it was a time when finally, you know, black people were being able to get into other types of jobs other than just the lowest and the most menial types of jobs. Every one of you rose to positions of importance within your fields. And I just find that fascinating. It's really the beginning of the rise of, you know, the black, I don't want to say middle class, because it's even more important than that, professional class, I'd say. Mm-hmm. And I know that many of you came, as Geraldine was saying, from a religious aspects to your backgrounds, largely because that was one way of moving in a leadership capacity at the time. But when things began to open up, you know, Al Cook became a scientist and opened up a medical laboratory consultancy that, you know, became a very important part of, particularly in Michigan. Al Lassiter went into the military, became spent 30 years there, retired as a colonel in the Air Force. Amina or Evelyn Pierce, a fascinating story of her own, but she was a college administrator, high school teacher, and married the brother of Malcolm X, and there's a whole other story to go along with that.
Wow.
You know, Ethel Sawyer got her doctorate at Washington University at St. Louis and became an educator. So, I mean, there's so many of you who went on to big careers. And, you know, for me, as just getting back to Berinsky, maybe like a social scientist, it really does seem like this was a start to something that was happening in the country, and you all grabbed hold of it and you know, took it as your own. Geraldine, maybe you want to talk a little bit about your journey kind of after your time at Tougaloo.
Oh, yes. I shared with a program that I was on the other day that I really kept a low key because my family owned a sundry shop, gas station on a piece of property that we had in the area. And because of the situation, not only for me, but my family, my family endured the Ku Klux Klan's riding horses into the place. They didn't fire my dad from the IP job, but it was well known that he had a daughter that had participated in this. So when I did finish my 3 years and three summers with a major in physical education and a minor in biological sciences and a minor in mathematics. I put my resume out there for many places around the area in the Miss Lou area, making a circle from Monroe to Baton Rouge, Vicksburg, and all of those areas. Within that area, and I did not get not one response in 6 months, but during that time, I had to have some ingenuity, so I designed a dance studio performance at the local recreational center, and I taught young children how to dance. And at the end of that time, I did a program for them. We had the community to come out and see what they had learned. And since I did that, I was able to put that dance in my resume and send it out again. But my family and I all believe that it was because of the participation in the Tougaloo 9 event that I was probably sort of blackballed or whatever kind of a name you want to say about it. But my family felt as though we were denied a lot of things because of being a part of this. And I say that because I know you want to know move forward on where we are now, but I just want to say that after the Tougaloo 9 sit-in, I went back and forth on the Greyhound bus or whatever bus was running between where I worked and my home, and I still tried to extend the attitude of having our rights acknowledged. So I continued to do things such as putting NAACP stickers on the bus windows and sitting in places that they determined that I could not sit, but I still did it anyway. And the driver of the bus would always see me coming, and he would put boxes all in the seats up front so that I couldn't sit him. And so I was still making myself a real nuisance and a challenge because, after all, I'd already been to jail, so you couldn't say that you were going to arrest me because I'd already been there and done that. So,
good for you. So what? How did you make your way after, you know, after that year of the dance studio and things like that? Tell us a little bit more.
I worked in Meridian as a physical education teacher with dance and gymnastics, and
go.
I did such a great job that I was moved to be a counselor. By that time, I was married and ready to have my family. So after my child was born, I moved back to Natchez, and I worked in one of the areas that they provided for the literacy of the people in the area. And I was a counselor there. I worked one of the first times I'd worked with a person that was not African-American. There were two white counselors, and I was one of the black counselors, and there was one other. So we had an integrated staff, and all of our clients were African-American people who needed help with their literacy.
Oh.
And because I was a counselor, I was able to do the testing of them and just be a part of the community. When my husband became finished with his tour of duty, he left and went all the way back to California. And so I followed him, and after some medical issues and things like that, just say this because I lost my eyesight and I couldn't see. But I was able to see well enough to handwrite my resume, and I submitted that to the superintendent in Oakland at that time. And because of my abilities and all of the things that I came with, having been to Tougaloo, I had taken the national teacher's exam, and so I had no problems getting a job. I was, in fact, as a recent person that had already been working, I was able to get on their fifth year pay scale. And
oh, yeah.
I was also able to choose the school that I wanted to work in. And when I asked the superintendent what were my choices, he gave me the dynamics of the difference between the hill schools and the flat schools. And I wanted to know the demographics of these students. And when he told me the difference, I chose the flatlands with the African American children rather than the hill area with the white children.
Mm-hmm.
And I set out to make a difference there in that area. I worked there for 10 years before I had enough hours and other degrees where I changed my my work from being just a physical education teacher to a specialist working with all abilities and as a consultant and as a author of handbooks for teachers and also as part of the national affiliation for health and physical education and as a person that was on the board for the Adapted PE conference where I did conferences and workshops in most of the western region and Hawaii.
Well, that just speaks to what I was saying, that, you know, the energy and the passion for each of your chosen fields, y'all just kept pushing and kept moving on and moving up. And that speaks to your entrepreneurial spirit. Another one of the entrepreneurs in the group, Janice Jackson, you know, became a realtor and is a well-regarded realtor in the St. Louis area. Joe, it's interesting that you and Joe both ended up in California.
Yeah.
And Joe, you moved there. You want to tell that story why you ended up heading to L.A.?
Well, yeah, because it just seems as though that my life, especially growing up in Memphis, was always intertwined with the energy to involve myself as an activist. And the reason why I left Memphis was because of the racial attitudes at that time when I was working at RCA Victor, I mean the major employer of Memphis. And this superintendent, I was a touch-up cabinet refinisher. And I did minor touch-up. In other words, the TV cabinets that were damaged, just a scratch or maybe a little chip on the corner of the TV set. But I could jump up on the moving line and repair that. But anything beyond that, it required major touch-up. So you had to pull that set off and let the major repairmen take care of that set. Well, he was running behind in production because of the continued damages that that the sets really had. And so this particular time I began to pull this set off a major touch up and Ron said, no, that's minor touch up. And then to make a long story short, he tried to force me to really repair that damaged set. And I tried and I tried, and then I looked at him, and he had that look in his eyes with his hands on his hips as if to say, nigger, you're going to do what I tell you to do. Well, I jumped off the belt and told Ron I didn't know whether he was going to, I mean, whether he was trying to fire me, but you know what? I quit. And I walked out of that plant. And that was in 68. and that's what caused me to come with to California with my brother-in-law, and we came out here to live with his sister. And so when I got out here, 4 months later, I arrived out here 50 years as of February the 11th. It's been 50 years that I've been in Orange County. But when I left, 4 months later, Dr. King was assassinated. And so then I became a custodian because I wanted to get back into college. And I had been out of college for 7 years, and I became a custodian, pushed that room for 3.5 years, and I received my BA in sociology, and then I became a career development officer, which really was about developing career ladders for minorities in the animal shelter department. And I did research and everything, submitted my findings, and the Board of Supervisors in Orange County personnel, they approved my findings, and that made it possible for more minorities to really to move into jobs that paid well. Well, after that, I took the test for the probation department, and that was the greatest thing that I could have ever done. I passed. And I was involved in a program called the Intercept Program, Michael. And here, you know, I noticed that the sheriffs and the police departments, they were really detaining youngsters only because of the color of their skin. You know, then they would have a little record. But I noticed all of the kids that could have been released home, they detained them for 72 hours and sent them to court. And so I was the only black working out of Lakewood Sheriff Station, saw the same prejudices as Norwalk Sheriff, Pico Rivera Sheriff, and I was in the Department of the Intake and Detention Control. And I did my best in counseling those youngsters and talking with their parents. And I saved a lot of kids from really entering much deeper into the criminal justice system.
Right, amazing. You were there for how many years? And
29 years and 7 months.
But who's counting, right?
I retired in 2002. Yeah.
Right.
But I was always involved in civil rights activity, even when I got out in California.
Right. Both of you spent the rest of your lives really working to help others, you know, kind of be lifted out of the circumstances that they found themselves in. It's just an amazing story. I want to bring back Patty, if she's still on the line, because I think, you know, she might have a perspective with regard to the impact of our time is kind of winding down here, the impact of the Tougaloo 9 on the city of Jackson and perhaps the state of Mississippi, and how they are kind of regarded now by the scholarly, you know, and those who focus on the civil rights movement. Patty, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm still here. I think the event that was held with the marker in front of the old municipal library really focused the city of Jackson on the Tougaloo 9. And I think their place in the Civil Rights Museum also has given them tremendous visibility. Jackson is a city where a lot of things happened, but they happened first. So their place here will always be special and will always mean a great deal to the community. I moved to Mississippi in 1981, and I moved down from Washington, D.C., and I moved to a little small town in South Mississippi, and they had a Klan march down the middle of Main Street the first week I was there.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was a profound thing for me to see. Because
welcome to Mississippi, right?
You know, I lived in all my neighborhoods in in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., so this was culture shock for sure.
Yeah.
And I had to start making a stand in many ways by leaving churches and, you know, making sure that everybody knew where I stood. So, you know, it's a good match for me to be at this library system in this city of Jackson, and I'm very proud of the role of the Tougaloo Nine. I did want to mention that Dr. Wayne Wagon, who appeared with Geraldine at ALA in Chicago, will be coming to Jackson on April 18th, and he will be giving a book talk about his book, which is covering the history of libraries and desegregation in the South. So that's also going to bring focus to the Tougaloo Nine again. So
I can't wait for his book. It's coming out in April, as I understand it. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've asked the Civil Rights Museum to make sure that he gets the kind of recognition when he comes to Jackson that he deserves. So he has asked me to invite the Tougaloo Nine. I know that y'all have traveled. I have to say, Joseph, that it is really super interesting to talk to you. I don't know if you saw Rachel Maddow's Best Thing of the Week, in which
yes.
you all featured.
Yes.
And I thought it was great that she started with you, so, because you did not get to come in August. So
she got quite emotional there at the end of that.
She really did, and
yeah.
I was quite amazed, you know, because I didn't think that the whole world would get to hear about our civil rights markers. But it was a terrible week with a lot of really bad news in other parts of the country with the Black Lives Matter movement, and I think that the recognition of the Tougaloo Nine at that particular time was great. It was
amazing. Gave everybody a lift.
It really brought a national attention to their role in the civil rights movement. So I'm extremely proud to have had the chance to bring their story to greater recognition here in Jackson. But many people already knew about it. It just happened that they were in 1961, and a lot of the Freedom Summer in 1964 reminiscence, they were too early to really fit into that. So I'm so glad that we were able to do it. And it's just great to see that marker shining in the sunshine and everybody that drives down State Street, which is a major street in Jackson, can easily see their accomplishment.
Well, it's great that it's there, and it's great that you were placed in a situation, in a position where you could help make sure that it happens. So we're so grateful to you for that. We just have a couple more minutes here before we're out of time. I wonder
Michael, I really wanted to share this with you. My son's lady friend, who happens to be Irish.
Right.
I thought I'd mention that. Is a third grade school teacher at the Third Street elementary school in the exclusive Hancock Park area. She was just so fascinated with our story. Do you know she wrote a script from the newspaper articles and also from talking with me about, you know, the Tougaloo Nine experience? Do you know she presented a play as of February the 16th of last month, and
wow.
her eighth graders, who are 8 years old, they did a reenactment of the Tougaloo Nine at her school.
Amazing, amazing! Your story is just—it's growing in interest, and it's a wonderful thing to have happen at this particular time of life, right? To know
right.
that you had that kind of impact to inspire others. Geraldine, any last words?
Oh, yes. I want to thank you, Mike. You did a wonderful job of directing us. And if anyone else was on, I'm sure that they listened intensely of the Two Blue Nine. I know that some of them said that they will probably be on, but right now they didn't come through, and that happens. I've been on these shows for a minute now, and my show is called the Voices of Wisdom, and I've been on for the first Thursday in the month every month, and I'll be doing that until June. And then I'll have a break and get back to it in September. So I want to say to you, Patty Furr, you have been so consistently supportive with me since I met you 2012, I believe. And each year that I come down, there is always something great to talk about and to look forward to. I would just like to have a roll call. Joseph, you and I, we are over here in California, and we can talk anytime. So hold on for the next minute or so. And I just wanted to acknowledge, Mike, that you've done a great job of bringing out Alfred Lee Cook, Sr.
Thank you.
He's actually in Michigan now.
Right.
Janice Jackson Bales, he's in Ferguson, Missouri now. Ethel Dolphy, she's in St. Louis. Meredith Andens, who I talked with, and he had death in the family, he definitely wanted to be on, and he said that he wanted to continue to see the growth and the support of the Two Glue Nine, because he is and was from Jackson, still is there half the year, and so he just wants to see the acknowledgement continue. He was really interested to let us know that he could not make it because of death in the family.
Right.
Colonel Albert Lassiter, who you brought out very well, and he has been supportive in ways that, and as Patty Farr said, all of the Two Blue Nine made it to the marker placing, and except for Joseph. So therein, we have the participation. Let me bring in Sammy, James Sammy Bradford, who lives there in Tougaloo. And he speaks to organizations and groups when no other Tougalooan is around. So we have Sammy to be thankful for the fact that he is there to be able to hold up the banner for the Tougaloo Nine in that area. Joseph. He didn't tell you all of the things, but, hey, we've got a lot more that we can speak about. And, Mike, you brought out so much, and I would love for us to continue to interact with you as the year closes out. Hopefully you will be willing to do that. And we know that Evelyn Pierce, who's Dr. Omina Omor, I love what you brought out about her. And we'd just like to acknowledge, because if some didn't get on, they'll probably go in and listen on the link. So we have her sisters. There are three sisters and three brothers. And I do know that we do have connection with a couple of them, because they did come to the marker placing, and Meredith has connections with one of the brothers with whom I talk with him about. So on another show, we are going to reach forward and continue to bring the Two Blue Nine together, because this is one of the things that we need. And when I talked with those that with whom I talked with, they all want to do this. Now, the circumstances are always not always conducive for what we want at the time that we want it, but the goal is that we are all going to be on one accord, and that we're going to try to reach out to each other, and we're going to have a cohesive following from here on.
Wonderful.
So, I would like to congratulate you, Joseph. You did well.
Well, that means a lot. That's worth more than gold, Geraldine, coming from you. Thank you very much.
And Geraldine, you're going to lead us out,
Joseph,
right?
And I. Yes, Joseph and I will banter from here on. So thank you, Patty, for I hope that Ellen will get all of this information also, because she is so supportive, and I thank you for allowing her to help us, and thank
anytime.
You all.
Absolutely. Anytime I can do anything for the Tougaloo Nine, just let me know, because I'm here ready and waiting.
Thank you so much for
and Patty,
that. With
and,
that.
And Patty and Michael, may the good Lord bless and keep both of you until we are able to meet again.
Thank you, Joseph. That means a lot to me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome.
And I do hope that you let everyone know that the link from the program today can be shared. So we are not losing any audience. In fact, we are making it possible for everyone who wants to know to keep up with the Tougaloo Nine and our getting together.
We will this post it on our webpage, Geraldine, if you send it to us. And I know a lot of people in the Jackson area will want to get in and listen to this program. So please send it to me and we'll post it.
I certainly will. We do post it on Facebook, but it's also posted on emails, and I will try my best to make sure that everyone is able to get this link. And this is just the beginning of getting the Tougaloo Nine together. Okay, so with that, we are going to close out and let everyone know that I'm Geraldine Hollis. I am the host of this show, Voices of Wisdom, and I appreciate all of the support. Michael, you did a great job again, and your book and your information and everything is out there, and I want people to know that you are the author of We Shall Not Be Moved. And if you haven't read it, please go out and check it out. And, of course, my book, Back to Mississippi, tells you a lot about what I have experienced and what I have seen that has happened. And I'll share that with you as I close off. I have another book that is March Memories, and both of those books are available to each and everyone who would like to have a copy, whether it's in e-book or soft book or a hard book. So just check with me on www.backtomississippi.com or Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any online store. Thank you so much, and I'll be looking forward to hearing from each and every one. And as Joseph always say, we are so blessed, and we have nothing but good Lord to...
Amen.
Yes, nobody but the good Lord
for God.
That.
Okay.
Because we're still living and still breathing, and we're still here. Thank you all, and to all of you, nothing but the best. At this, we're going to sign off, and we'll have just a little bit of music to close us out. And this is it. Thanks to Miss Beverly Black and the Gumbo for the Soul and Tribe Family Channel International. We are able to give this information and have this opportunity to share with those who want to know. Thank you all again. And I'll look for you on the web, the email, the text, or whatever it takes so that we can continue to stay connected. All right.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges, because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. somewhere I read, yes. of the freedom of speech,
yes.
somewhere I read,
yes.
of the freedom of press,
yes.
somewhere I read,
yes.
that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
Yes.
So just as I say, we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around. We aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now. Because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
I don't think any of us can be satisfied in the United States until that war is brought to an honorable end and American soldiers are brought back here to the United States.
One day, we will have to stand before the God of history and we will talk in terms of things we've done. And it seems that I can hear the God of history saying, that was not enough. But I was hungry, and ye fed me not.
Tri-Family Channel, oh, Voices of Wisdom.